Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. This week we're in our second reading from the double issue dated September 10th, September 17th, 2021. We did a lot of the main stories and current news last week. This week we'll start on the briefing page titled, A Big Bet on Amtrak. The bipartisan infrastructure bill could revitalize interstate rail travel in the U.S., but will Americans embrace trains? How much will Amtrak get? The $1 trillion bill provides the quasi-public rail corporation with a $66 billion cash infusion, a massive increase in funding over the $2 billion it currently gets in federal subsidies a year. The new cash will enable the beleaguered passenger rail operator to improve nationwide service while expanding to new cities. The bill directs $24 billion in funding to the Northeast Corridor, Amtrak's most popular and heavily used line, which connects Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, with trains reaching up to 150 miles per hour. The bill also dedicates $22 billion to the existing national network, which will provide better service to such high-traffic routes as Chicago-Milwaukee and Portland-Seattle, and $12 billion to new rail services, which Amtrak plans to use to expand to smaller cities like Boise, Idaho, Madison, Wisconsin, Nashville, and President Biden's hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania. The president, who famously commuted by Amtrak from Delaware to D.C. while serving in the Senate, called the funding a once-in-a-generation opportunity to make rail a crucial part of America's transportation future. We can make investments that get America back on track. No pun intended, Biden said. How did rail service get off track? It was a casualty of America's car culture. In the 19th century, the U.S. pioneered rail travel to speed people and goods across a vast continent. By the 1850s, passenger rail service was booming, drastically reducing intercity travel times and opening the West to large-scale settlement. But by the 1920s, the number of rail passengers began to plummet as more Americans became automobile owners. That trend accelerated after World War II when President Dwight Eisenhower signed the Interstate Highway Act, which funded the grid of cross-country high-speed roads that became the modern interstate system. Passenger rail would never be the same. Why has Amtrak struggled? Amtrak was created in 1971 by combining several failing private passenger rail networks into a for-profit company receiving government subsidies. To the never-ending frustration of Republican lawmakers, Amtrak has never made a profit. To the frustration of Democrats, it has always received drastically less funding than the interstate highway system. Amtrak been plagued by slow service due to decades-old infrastructure. The actual average speed of the Northeast Corridor's Acela trains is just 84 miles per hour, compared with 180 miles per hour or more for high-speed lines in Europe and Asia. In much of the U.S., tracks are owned by more profitable freight train companies, which get priority use. The nation's only high-speed project, which was supposed to connect San Francisco and Los Angeles, has become a much-delayed, vastly over-budgeted boondoggle that would cost $23 billion to go just 171 miles from Merced to Bakersville. It is not mentioned in the infrastructure bill. Are trains successful abroad? High-speed rail is ubiquitous in Japan, Taiwan, and much of Europe, where distances between cities are shorter, and governments see rail as a public service to be subsidized rather than a for-profit business. China has blanketed its sprawling country with 23,500 miles of high-speed lines connecting every major urban center, including far-flung western cities. Its centralized government does not need to overcome public opposition to construction or heavy state investment. And in China, the per-mile cost to build high-speed rail is less than half of California's. Why are train projects so expensive? It's not just the trains. America's highways, roads, bridges, and tunnels also cost many billions to build for a host of complex reasons. The conventional wisdom is that American unions and high labor costs are the cause, but research by economist and transit researcher Alan Levy of the Libertarian Niskanen Center point to other factors. Bureaucratic mismanagement by officials who know little about rail or construction, environmental laws requiring impact statements that take an average of 4.5 years to complete, and not in my backyard, NIMBY, lawsuits by residents and wealthy interests. Once the construction process starts, people complain, New York University professor and transit researcher Eric Goldwyn told Vox.com, and those complaints lead to lawsuits. One study found that the cost to build a mile of highway grew by 500% between 1990 and 2008. Building a new subway line on 2nd Avenue in New York cost $2.6 billion per mile. Rail advocates hope Amtrak will learn from Europe, where more experienced planning agencies have streamlined processes to handle citizen complaints and environmental reviews. How will Amtrak use the money? Don't expect the U.S. to develop a high-speed rail system like Europe's or China's. It's simply not practical. The money will primarily go into repairing and upgrading Amtrak's existing rail network and in creating new routes to cities with existing freight lines. The hope is that if service becomes faster, more reliable, and more far-reaching, Americans tired of jam-packed highways and the hassles and delays of air travel will give trains a try and become repeat customers. The infrastructure bill gives Amtrak a significant new mandate. It will not be expected to make a profit. Instead, it will be a taxpayer-supported service to meet the inner-city passenger rail needs of the United States. We'll pick up a few more of the columns that we skipped over last week, starting with anti-vaxxers who die of COVID. COVID karma has come for scores of anti-vax influencers, said Charlie Sykes. Caleb Wallace, 30, the Texas organizer of an anti-mask mandate freedom rally, recently got COVID and self-medicated with vitamin C, zinc, and ivermectin. He died this week, leaving behind a wife and four children with no means of support. Talk show host Phil Valentine also died of the virus after broadcasting a parody of the Beatles song Taxman called Vaxman to mock inoculations. In recent weeks, COVID killed radio host Dick Farrell, who called Dr. Anthony Fauci a power-tripping lying freak. Christian radio host Jimmy DeYoung, who said the vaccine was a form of government control, and Mark Bernier, who compared U.S. health officials to Nazis because they advocate vaccines and masks. It's almost as if natural selection was trying very hard to make a point. Some of the anti-vaxxers expressed regret in their dying days, but these active spreaders of disinformation spent months encouraging legions of gullible followers to scorn scientists and shun masks and vaccines. With this cynical denialism still prevailing on Fox News, talk radio, and other right-wing media, we can only guess how many viewers and listeners will share the same unpublicized fate. the court's activist interventions. President Biden has found himself in a losing battle with the Supreme Court's so-called shadow docket, said Kimberly Atkins Store. Each summer, the court can issue terse summary orders drafted out of sight, often issued at night, and without a full detailed opinion justifying decision. Two recent shadow docket cases demonstrate the breadth of its reach. In two 6-3 opinions along partisan lines, the court's conservative majority temporarily reinstated former Trump's Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers until the case is heard by an appeals court. It then ruled that Biden had exceeded his powers by extending the eviction moratorium past July 31st. Trump won most cases his administration brought by an emergency application, with the court giving deference to presidential authority to shape immigration and foreign policy. But the justices have been far less deferential to his successor, even rebuking him with no further legal explanation for the arbitrary and capricious way he overturned the Remain in Mexico policy. More losses are in store for Biden and for the American people, who deserve far more transparency and accountability from the court. This is comes from Albania. Albania is one of the poorest countries in Europe, said Alfred Peza, but we are making international headlines by throwing open our doors to Afghan refugees. Our nation of 3 million people has volunteered to shelter 4,000 Afghans, and we do so, Prime Minister Edi Rama explained, not just because our great allies ask us to, but because we are Albania. It's partly that we Albanians know what it is to be dependent on the goodwill of other nations. After World War I, we were threatened with partition until U.S. President Woodrow Wilson took us under his protection. And our sister nation, the majority ethnic Albanian Kosovo, would not be independent without the 1999 NATO military intervention that helped free it from the Serbian yoke. Yet it is also inherent in our culture to protect the downtrodden. The most majestic example of this trait was seen during World War II, when our majority Muslim country became a haven for Jews fleeing the Holocaust. Even while we were under Nazi occupation, Albania didn't hand over a single person, and our Jewish population grew from 200 to 2,000. As that famous Albanian, Mother Teresa, used to say, "Don't look for big things. Do small things with great love." This column comes from Nigeria. Can Islamist terrorists really change? Boko Haram fighters say they are repenting and quitting terrorism. But can we trust them? Asked Eddie Odivri. Over the past month, our military has released photos showing hundreds of the Islamist jihadists surrendering to soldiers in northeast Borno state, some of them holding signs begging Nigerians for forgiveness. That's a big ask. Boko Haram has killed more than 100,000 people and forced thousands of kidnapped girls into marriage during its 12-year campaign to impose an especially brutal form of Sharia law on northern Nigeria. Many Nigerians believe these militants are not deserving of pardons and should instead be made to answer for all their gruesome crimes. But that insistence on justice will surely scare off any militants who may be considering renouncing Boko Haram, incentivizing them to stick with the group and keep killing and maiming more innocent people. If we want peace, we must take a risk and encourage the remnants to come forth and surrender. That doesn't mean blind trust. Clearly, many militants are laying down their weapons only because they see that our army is winning. We will have to place them under intense surveillance, not only by the security agencies, but also by community leaders. Mercy is necessary, but we mustn't be naive. Here's a few pieces from the technology page. Microchips, the shortage caused by a shortage. The global chip shortage is not going to end anytime soon, said Jamie Powell in the Financial Times. There had been signs in recent months that the pandemic caused strain on global semiconductor supply chains, which has slowed the production of everything from cars to refrigerators to computer graphics cards, was finally easing. General Motors raised guidance in early June on better chip supply, and the stock price of some semiconductor manufacturers was beginning to come down from February highs, but we're not out of the woods quite yet. Toyota had faced the crisis better than its rivals, but last month announced it was slashing global production for September by 40% because of the shortage. This has major implications for the global economy. If the world's largest car manufacturer by volume can't secure enough chips, what hope is there for smaller firms? The nature of the shortage has changed, said Kate Marino in Axios.com. The main problem during the first half of the year was a dearth of wafers, the base upon which circuits are embedded. But there's now a shortage of the equipment that assembles those wafers into integrated circuits. Why? Well, that equipment needs chips too. The world's largest chip maker is raising prices to try to cool demand, said Yang Ji in the Wall Street Journal. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, which produces 90% of the world's most advanced chips, announced last week that it will soon charge 10 to 20% more for most semiconductors. The higher income will help TSMC invest aggressively in new capacity and shrink the backlog. Apple is one of TSMC's biggest clients, said Kaim Gartenberg in TheVerge.com. And their tech giant is set to release a new lineup of iPhones later this month. While there are a lot of factors that go into the price of phones beyond the actual bills of materials, buyers should be prepared to have to pay more. Some good will come of this crisis, said The Economist. For starters, auto firms will have to raise the resiliency of their supply chains. As demand for new vehicles slumped at the start of the pandemic, the car industry, which is used to ordering suppliers around, cut their orders with chip makers. When the demand for cars bounced back last summer, the industry found itself at the back of the queue for chips, far behind the more influential tech industry. That unpleasant experience has spurred Volkswagen to draw up plans to develop driver assistance chips in-house. But there will also be lasting negative consequences, including the rise of techno-nationalism. America is already planning to hand out billions of dollars to lure chip makers back from East Asia. Such subsidies almost always lead to overcapacity. Our next chip crisis could be one of too many chips on the market and calls for public money to prop up uncompetitive businesses. Here's a few shorter tech pieces. Drone deliveries down under. A small city in Australia has become the drone delivery capital of the world, said James Vincent in TheVerge.com. Wing, a drone company operated by Google parent Alphabet, has completed some 100,000 deliveries since 2018, more than half of which were made in the Brisbane suburb of Logan. Users there can order a selection of goods, including coffee, groceries, sushi, cakes, pet food, and sportswear, and a drone will deliver them in under 10 minutes on average. The aircraft doesn't need to land to drop off the goods. It lowers them from a 20-foot tether. Logan has been a successful testing ground for Wings Tech, but finding other suitable delivery locations is tricky. The drones require small areas without overhanging trees or power lines. Feds boost use of facial recognition. Numerous federal agencies plan to expand their facial recognition capabilities by 2023, said Drew Harrell in the Washington Post, despite growing concerns about the technology's accuracy and privacy issues. Most of the government's current uses for face scanning are commonplace and uncontroversial, including for secure doorway access or to match a person's face to their passport. The Government Accountability Office has been informed of plans to upgrade or build new facial recognition features at 10 agencies. The State Department is researching how the process of aging could affect its system's accuracy for assessing children's passport photos. The Department of Transportation, meanwhile, is studying eye-tracking systems to measure the alertness of truck drivers and air traffic controllers. Pirates streaming bonanza. It's never been easier to watch a high-quality pirated version of a Hollywood movie online, said R.T. Watson and Eric Schwartzel in the Wall Street Journal. Copies of recent blockbusters such as Jungle Cruise and Black Widow proliferated across piracy sites within hours of their premieres. It used to take months after the film's theatrical release for such copy to spread online, but bootlegging has been made easier by studios' pandemic-era practice of releasing films simultaneously in movie theaters and on U.S. streaming services such as HBO Max. And those services' built-in subtitling features give pirates a way to create ready-made versions for foreign audiences. Black Widow wasn't released in China, but Beijing resident Kevin He, 25, watched a 4K copy of the film online almost immediately after it hit Disney Plus. Time to take a look at our in-depth article, The Last Word, this week titled, The Case for UFO Skepticism. Perhaps the unexplained flying objects spotted by pilots are alien spacecraft that traveled at least 25 trillion miles to spy on Earth, said Joel Achenbach in the Washington Post magazine. But scientists have good reason to doubt it. Friends and colleagues have urged me to write something about UFOs because the topic is hot again, and I'm sort of the space alien reporter on staff. This refers not to where I'm from, but to the kind of stuff I used to write about. I wrote a book, Captured by Aliens, 1999, that was primarily about the scientific research for extraterrestrial life and included a long section on UFO mythology. I've been to Roswell. I wrote about the mass suicide of the 39 Heaven's Gate cultists who thought they would be transported to a spaceship trailing the comet Hale-Bopp. I've interviewed people who think their bodies have become inhabited by aliens from Pleiades. But I'm wary of returning to that strange universe because anything I write is guaranteed to be unsatisfying for everyone involved. My strong suspicion is that the number of UFO sightings that involve actual alien beings from deep space with the tentacles and the antenna and so on is zero. I would put the likelihood at 0.0000 and then add some more zeros before eventually, begrudgingly, because I'm so intellectually flexible, putting in a little one out there somewhere to the right. A lonely sentinel, because who knows? Yes, I'm saying there's a chance. Science journalists regularly disappoint people by refusing to confirm really cool things like UFOs, past life recall, astral projection, telekinesis, clairvoyance, and so on. When I wrote my aliens book, I made a disastrous marketing mistake by not including any aliens in the story, focusing instead on people who believe in aliens. Over the years, I have found less joy in telling the believers that what they believe is not true. It gets old, always telling people to stop reading the horoscope. We all rely on our beliefs to get through the day. They are our handrails on a shaky planet. People don't need someone with a fanatical desire to be correct to come along and pry their fingers loose. Make no mistake, I want to be the reporter who goes out on a limb and breaks the space alien story. I want my name on a front page story with a 72-point headline saying, they're here. That would be a great career-making story. But the aliens never deliver. The classic UFO narrative, the interesting conjecture, the one with extraterrestrial beings in it, involves a ziggurat of unknowns and unknowables. We're talking about elusive spacecraft piloted by unknown beings of unknown biology using unknown technologies, whose motives are unknown. This subject is outside the normal boundaries of logic, journalism, and science. Let's review the UFO Renaissance for those of you who have been paying attention to other purely terrestrial stuff, like the pandemic. On June 25th, the U.S. National Intelligence Community released a long-awaited report on UFOs. The report by the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force, UAP is the Pentagon's rebranding of UFOs, followed a series of articles in recent years about videos taken by Navy pilots showing mysterious objects, some of which appear to be moving at astonishing speeds and with motion unlike any known terrestrial aircraft. The U.S. intelligence investigation looked at 144 reports involving UAPs. It solved only one of them. With the exception of the one instance where we determined with high confidence that the reported UAP was an airborne clutter, specifically a deflating balloon, we currently lack sufficient information in our data set to attribute incidents to specific explanations, the report said. Instead, it offered five distinct categories of explanations: airborne clutter, natural atmospheric phenomena, U.S. government, or industry developmental programs, foreign adversary systems, and a catch-all other bin. Despite the inconclusive nature of the report, it was greeted by something of a triumph by people who are active in UFO research. What UFO proponents have long wanted is for the government, the media, and the scientific establishment to take the subject seriously. The intelligence report does that. It says that some of the reports appear to involve real objects because they were observed by multiple instruments or witnesses. There's something there. It's not imaginary. So, yeah, unidentified flying objects do exist. This UFO moment is strikingly reminiscent of how the UFO mythology began in 1947. On June 24th of that year, a pilot named Kenneth Arnold reported seeing nine mysterious objects traveling near Mount Rainier at high speed. Arnold said the objects flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water, and the media took it from there, inventing the concept of flying saucers. Soon the whole nation was quite obsessed. Not long afterward, a balloon-borne military surveillance instrument crashed on a ranch near Roswell, New Mexico. And even though it looked nothing like a flying saucer or, for that matter, anything remotely extraterrestrial, the debris somehow spontaneously generated a series of increasingly dramatic narratives, culminating in a sturdy hoax about recovered alien bodies and reverse-engineered alien aerospace technology. In those early days of ufology, the classic story involved something in the sky seen by pilots or ordinary citizens, mysterious lights. Then the mythology took an interesting turn. People started getting abducted by aliens. It happened in their sleep. Science fiction writer Whitley Strieber wrote a book, Communion, that claimed that such abduction had happened to him. Then a Harvard professor, John Mack, wrote a book saying that the reason people believed that they were being abducted by aliens is that they were, in fact, being abducted by aliens. They came from another dimension. That mythology ran its course, maybe after being so thoroughly narrativized by the X-Files. Now we've come full circle. Pilots are once again seeing things they can't understand. The difference is this time there are videos. The Republic of Science is engaged in the study of observable natural phenomena. I have lifted both phrases from Richard Rhodes' monumental book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. This is why science and science journalism are not well equipped to fact-check religious beliefs. Religions typically involve events that are neither natural nor necessarily observable on demand, and that is where science runs into trouble with UFO reports. Science is often mistaken for a list of things we know. It is really just a system, a set of techniques and principles for investigating the world. It's very successful as a method of interrogating the natural world. It revealed, among other things, that the universe is imponderably vast and marvelous. Unfortunately, the system, although able to penetrate the cosmic darkness, is less successful for detecting things conjectured to be in some manner cloaked, or able to duck into a different dimension or parallel universe. Maybe the aliens traverse the universe in wormholes that are invisible to us. But how would you know? The alien explanation for UFOs requires a massive infrastructure of presumptions, not least of which is that the aliens, whatever their motivation, have found a way to get here. Deep space is deceptive because it is generally transparent and we see things that are incredibly distant. The nearest star is about 25 trillion miles away, and although that sounds like hyperbole, it is, in fact, the correct number. So, to do space travel, you really need warp drive, and there is no such thing as warp drive. Okay, now there is no such thing, but as we get better and smarter, we might figure it out, and the aliens who are billions of years older than us may have solved warp drive long ago. That is speculation, though. It's not based on anything at all. It's what scientists refer to as arm waving. The unhappy reader thinks this guy is refusing to think outside the box. And that's a fair criticism. Science writers tend to linger in the box, and that can lead them to miss important developments. The pandemic comes to mind. Indeed, some intellectual humility must come into play in these debates about UFOs and other contentious topics. One of the first things you discover in science journalism is that the best scientists tend to be transparent about their uncertainties. This is partly because much research is conducted on the edge of the known, in fuzzy territory. But it's also because scientists tend to view knowledge as provisional. While covering the pandemic over the past year and a half, the statement I've heard most from scientists is, "We don't know. When will the pandemic be over? We don't know. Why do some people get really sick or even die after a coronavirus infection, and others don't even get the sniffles? We don't know. Where did the virus come from exactly? We don't know." This is not a failure of science. It's what makes science so effective. The good scientists don't start with a conclusion. UFO skepticism can sometimes be mistaken for anthropocentrism, a kind of biological arrogance. The issue of whether a UFO sighting involves an actual alien spaceship can turn, with head-snapping speed, into a philosophical debate, with an accusation at its core. The believer says to the skeptic, "So you think in all the universe, among billions and billions of galaxies, each with billions and billions of stars and untold number of planets, we humans are the only form of intelligent life?" It would actually be reassuring at a deep existential level to know that interstellar space travel is possible. Alien visitors, by their mere existence, would imply that we can overcome our worst instincts, war, hatred, pollution, Twitter, and survive. It would be nice to know that the kind of intelligence humans possess and which gives rise to technological civilizations like ours won't always backfire. What's more anthropocentric, though, is to assume that human beings are so fascinating that aliens want to visit us and study us. The aliens seem a bit obsessed with us. Some UFO narratives imagine that we have something the aliens are missing, like feelings. When you're doomed to life as an intelligent reptilian from Rigel, you will go a long way to get some warm and fuzzy human DNA. Another common theme is that we humans were, in fact, engineered by aliens. We are their prized creation. In this scenario, we're not just a highly successful, so far, species of primate. We're super special. That's straight out of the book of Genesis. Let's cut to the key question. Are we alone? The plaintive tone of that question tells you how much we want the answer to be no. Unfortunately, there's no one solid, incontrovertible answer. We don't know. A couple of decades ago, I posed the Are We Alone question to Stephen Jay Gould, the Harvest paleontologist and prodigious author of popular science books. Gould had long thought through the question of the evolution of human species in the grand context of life on Earth over the course of 4 billion years. When I asked Gould about intelligent life beyond Earth, he answered, "No data." This was true then and remains true today, with the caveat that astronomers have discovered that planets are common, and many appear to be small, rocky Earth-like planets. The abundance of plausible habitats for life boosts the odds that life is common, and therefore has plenty of opportunity to achieve, through the trial and error of natural selection, complexity, and perhaps intelligence. My assumption is that intelligent life is out there. What happened on Earth probably has happened or will happen on other worlds. But this is just a hunch. It's not a belief. I believe in a bunch of other stuff, though. I believe in the usefulness of science. I believe in footnotes. I believe in peer review. I believe in the value of expertise. I also believe that holding views that are provisional and potentially subject to change is not a sign of intellectual weakness, but rather one of intellectual modesty. And I believe the future will surprise us. There could come a day when we make contact with the old ones. But in the meantime, UFOs are a distraction. We have pressing concerns that merit our full attention. Viruses, humans, the biosphere, terrestrial life. And let's never assume someone from space is going to save us. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post magazine. We'll read a few pieces from the business page this week. Apple cracking open the App Store. Apple is changing its App Store rules as it seeks to fend off a growing wave of regulatory scrutiny and legal challenges, said Bradley Olson in the Wall Street Journal. Nearly 70,000 app developers filed suit against the tech giant in 2019, accusing it of breaching antitrust laws by forcing customers to pay for in-app services via the App Store, where Apple charges a commission of up to 30%. To settle that case, Apple announced last week that developers will now be allowed to tell customers about alternative payment methods outside Apple's ecosystem, something it had previously prohibited. The company also established a $100 million fund for small developers. Make no mistake, Apple isn't giving up much in this deal, said Ty Kim in Bloomberg.com. The company took in roughly $22 billion in profits last quarter, so $100 million is chicken feed. And its self-declared major concession to let developers email customers about alternative payment options still leaves in place Apple's far more restrictive ban on links to and descriptions of external, potentially cheaper purchasing methods from within apps. Perhaps the meager agreement will have a short shelf life. A federal judge is expected to rule on similar antitrust lawsuit brought by Fortnite maker Epic Games. But we'll have to see. Fed tapering could start this year. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell indicated last week that the central bank will soon start curbing its easy money policy, said Jeff Cox in CNBC.com. In a speech at the Fed's annual symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Powell said the strength of the economic recovery meant the bank could begin dialing down its monthly bond purchases this year. But he added that any interest rate hike was far in the distance because the economy has ground cover to reach maximum employment. Powell's insistent that the current surge in prices is transitory and inflation will drop eventually to the target level of 2%. Coffee, a Java crisis in Vietnam. A COVID surge in Vietnam could make your morning brew costlier, said Emiko Terrazono and Judith Evans in the Financial Times. Vietnam is the leading exporter of Robusta coffee, the bitter-tasting bean used for instant coffee as well as for some espresso blends. But a sharp rise in coronavirus cases in recent weeks has caused the Vietnamese government to impose a strict lockdown in Ho Chi Minh City, making it hard for exporters to get beans to the ports. Robusta's futures hit $2,043 a ton last week, up nearly 50% since the start of the year. A pandemic boom for travel agencies. Travel agents are cool again, said Scott McCartney in the Wall Street Journal. Only now they like to be called travel advisors. Many travel agencies were killed off by the rise of do-it-yourself online booking, but the industry is now expanding as would-be vacationers and businesses look for help navigating virus-related complexity, uncertainty, cancellations, delays, border restrictions, and testing requirements. In a recent survey, 44% of travelers said they're more likely to use a travel advisor after the pandemic. Avi Gilbert, a stock market analyst in Maryland, once scoffed at the idea of paying somebody to make travel arrangements when he could book a trip with a few clicks. But planning amid COVID chaos became too stressful, and he hired an advisor. It paid off. The advisor used her connections to get him a refund on a $10,000 non-refundable booking at a Caribbean hotel. And we'll just flip over to a few of the health and science pieces. A worrying rainfall at the top of the world. Something very strange happened last month at the normally freezing high point of the Greenland ice sheet. It rained there for the first time in recorded history. The shower at the National Science Foundation Summit Station, which is 500 miles inside the Arctic Circle and nearly 2 miles above sea level, is yet another disturbing sign of the effects climate change is having on the Arctic. Scientists say it rained on and off for 13 hours on August 14th, but they don't know how much fell because, as downpours aren't expected at this altitude, the station has no rain gauges. The rain coincided with warmer temperatures that caused extensive melting across the ice sheet. Temperatures hit 33 degrees Fahrenheit at the ice sheet's peak, the third time in 10 years that above-freezing conditions have been recorded there. Before this century, such warm spells occurred only 6 times in 2,000 years. With temperatures in the Arctic rising twice as fast as the global average, the 650,000-square-mile Greenland ice sheet has been steadily losing ice and contributing to the rising sea levels. Marco Tedesco from Columbia University says rainfall at the summit won't directly contribute to sea level rise because the water drains into the ice rather than into the ocean. But if this is happening at the summit, the effect at lower elevations will be more violent, he tells New York Times, and that ice is actually going to the ocean. Farming pesticide ban. The Environmental Protection Agency has banned a pesticide linked to neurological damage in children, ending a years-long legal battle. Farmers have been spraying chlorpyrifos on crops such as strawberries, apples, citrus, broccoli, and corn since 1965, reports NPR.org. The chemical has been linked to a host of issues for kids, such as reduced IQ, loss of working memory, and attention deficit disorders. Health organizations and farm workers' unions have been campaigning for the pesticide's ban for years. The EPA has been considering a ban, but under the Trump administration, it concluded there wasn't enough evidence showing chlorpyrifos harms humans. The new rule will take effect in 6 months. It took far too long, but children will no longer be eating food tainted with a pesticide that causes intellectual learning disabilities, said Patty Goldman, an attorney with Earth Justice, which represents health and labor organizations. Chlorpyrifos will finally be out of our fruits and vegetables. Not such a gentle giant. Giant tortoises have long been thought of as herbivores. But in a new study, one of these seemingly gentle beasts has been filmed in the Seychelles hunting and devouring a seabird chick in a single gulp. It was a very slow encounter, with the tortoise moving at its normal slow-walking pace, said co-author Justin Gerlach from Cambridge University. The whole interaction took 7 minutes and was quite horrifying. Researchers have long suspected the reptiles of having a hankering for meat, reports USA Today. Some giant tortoises feed on dead animals, bones, and snail shells, and there have been uncorroborated reports of them scarfing live animals. But this is the first time the act has been caught on video. Researchers say one reason giant tortoises may have developed a taste for meat in the Seychelles, the only place besides the Galapagos Islands where they are known to survive, is the growth of a colony of about 265,000 knotty terns. With chicks regularly falling from nests in trees, the temptation to grab a tasty snack may simply be too great. And we'll finish out the hour on the Talking Points page. We've got time for at least a couple of articles. We'll start with Kabul bombing, remembering the fallen soldiers. Amid the hectic rush of loading Afghan refugees onto a plane out of Kabul, Marine Sergeant Nicole Gee took a moment to cradle an infant evacuee in her arms. The 23-year-old soldier posted a photo of that moment on her Instagram account with a caption, "I love my job." Days later, she, 10 other Marines, an Army Special Ops soldier, and a Navy medic were all killed by an ISIS-K suicide bomber at the airport's gate, along with up to 170 Afghan victims. These heroes' deaths were not in vain, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. In the face of a looming terrorist threat, the soldiers bravely continued to evacuate more than 114,000 people to freedom, quite literally saving thousands of lives. There's plenty of blame to go around for the heartbreaking homecoming of their flag-draped caskets at Dover Air Force Base this week. From President Biden to ex-President Trump to the 70% of Americans who grew tired of Afghanistan and just wanted out. Some of these fallen soldiers were not even a year old when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in late 2001, said Richard Luscombe in TheGuardian.com. 20-year-old Lance Corporal Riley McCullum of Jackson, Wyoming, who joined the Marines at 18, was weeks away from becoming a father. Lance Corporal Jared Schmitz had been in Afghanistan only a few days. His father, Mark, said military service was something he always wanted to do. Two of those killed, Sergeant Gee and Sergeant Johnny Rosario Picardo of Lawrence, Massachusetts, were women, an indication of how traditional gender barriers in the military have eroded, said David Phillips in the New York Times. As Sergeants Picciardo and Gee respectfully searched Afghan women fleeing the repressive Taliban, the two soldiers spent their last hours standing on the dividing line between a society opening opportunities for women and one slamming them shut. "We Americans live in a country where less than 1% of the population serves in the military," said the Houston Chronicle in an editorial. "It's easy to take their sacrifices for granted. For years, most of us ignored the war that killed more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel until the deluge of harrowing recent headlines made it impossible. We can never repay the dead for their service, but the least we can do is find a moment to grieve." Afghan refugees, will the U.S. welcome them? "Since their country fell to the Taliban, the exodus of Afghans has swelled like a flash flood," said Christina Goldbaum and Najim Rahim in the New York Times. "In the past 2 weeks, some 117,000 Afghans clambered onto evacuating flights, often without luggage or any clue where they were headed. For now, many are housed in American military bases in Qatar, Bahrain, and Germany, where they will receive security and COVID screenings. Roughly 88,000 Afghans who worked for the U.S. government as translators or in other jobs already have or have applied for special immigrant visas, SIVs, allowing them to settle in the U.S., said Dave Lawler in Axios.com. "They are being first flown to military bases in New Jersey, Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin, where they can be quickly cleared. Other Afghan refugees might wait for weeks or months. In America, we don't know what will happen," said Zara, 28, an Afghan woman who had to leave her mother and siblings behind. "Will we make better lives for ourselves?" 90% of Democrats and 76% of Republicans say they will welcome Afghans like Zara, said Nicole Naria in Vox.com. Dozens of other countries have also pledged to accept Afghan refugees, with Canada inviting 25,000. Local resettlement programs in the U.S. are seeing an unprecedented outpouring of support, said Michelle Hackman in the Wall Street Journal. Donations of toiletries, toys, and other requested items are piling up faster than staff can open them. One of the programs, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, has received offers to volunteer from 42,000 people. After leaving the country in chaos, the U.S. can at least protect our allies from the most horrible outcomes under the new regime, said Phuong Tran Nguyen in TheBulwark.com. That circumstance applied also to the end of the Vietnam War back in 1975, when Americans received 130,000 Southeast Asian allies with open arms. Bigots had their hour early on, some holding signs that read, "Gooks go home." But when refugees arrived, both parties banded together in support. In Arkansas, Governor David Pryor personally welcomed the first Vietnamese arrivals as a high school band played the Star Spangled Banner. "We're again seeing signs of that spirit, just as in 1975, welcoming refugees with help redeem this country's soul after a long and disastrous war." Here's a, it must be true, I read it in the tabloids piece that caught my attention. An Australian farmer who was forced to miss a beloved aunt's funeral because of pandemic restrictions found a novel way to pay his respects. With a drone shot video of hundreds of sheep arranged in a heart shape. "It took me a few goes to get it right," said Ben Jackson of New South Wales. He started using food to lure the sheep to make shapes during the pandemic. "It certainly lifted my spirits," he said. The heart was a big hit on social media. "Maybe we all just need to give ourselves a big virtual hug," Jackson said. Another short note, the Capitol police officer who shot and killed Ashley Babbitt revealed his identity for the first time and said the shooting saved countless lives. As Babbitt and others broke into the room leading to the House chamber, congressional lawmakers were in jeopardy and serious danger, said Lieutenant Michael Byrd, a 28-year veteran of the Capitol Police. I know I was doing my job. Byrd has been the target of multiple death threats. On the poll watch, with the Delta variant surging, 68% of parents say they either have already vaccinated their children against COVID or will likely do so as soon as it's allowed for their age group, up from 52% in late June. Opposition to vaccinating their kids has dropped to 31%. Among adults, only 20% now say they are not likely to get vaccinated, the lowest level since the survey began. And we've time for two quotes. We'll start with one from G.K. Chesterton, who says, "Until we realize that things might not be, we cannot realize that things are." And we'll finish with a quote from Gloria Steinem, quoted in Parade, who says, "The future depends entirely on what each of us does every day. A movement is only people moving." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.